This is an interview with Betty Roberts at her home in Northeast Portland, Oregon. The interviewer for the Oregon Historical Society is Clark Hansen. The date is August 18th, 1994, and this is tape 19, side 1. In our last session, we had talked about the 1977 session. We'd gone through most of the issues in that session. And I was going to begin by asking you, in general, overall, what was your impression of the 77 session? How would you assess that session?
I can't remember what many of the major issues were, but I assume that it was still taxes and basic school support and that sort of thing that is just a is always in the legislature. But from my personal standpoint, I thought it was a very successful session. I had served on Ways and Means and been on judiciary, which was a good experience as a lawyer. And I was appointed on the last day of the session, just before adjournment, to be on the emergency board, which was the first time that I would serve in the interim on that body, which is a very significant one. It's sort of the legislature in session, mini legislature in session during the interim, because they make decisions on funding.
Isn't that rather controversial in and of itself?
Oh, yes. And when I wasn't on, when all of us who are not on the emergency board can criticize, because we want to be a part of that decision making. Once you're on the emergency board, you know, you defend it and say, but this is the most efficient way to operate in interims rather than bringing everybody back for all the votes all the time. And we don't have annual sessions and we don't have full-time legislature. So there has to be some group that is making some fiscal decisions during the interim, and that joint committee made up of members of both the House and the Senate is a good way to do that. It's efficient. Many, when I was not on the emergency board, took issue with many of the things that they did in the interim, but there was always a next session to try to set things right again. So for me, I thought that it was a pretty successful session.
Maybe you could comment a little bit on what was going on in the House during that session. I'm referring to the six-pack, the power struggle in the Oregon House during May, in which Speaker Phil Lang, Democrat, was stripped of his power by a coalition.
Yeah. The coalition and those six members of the House attempted to take a great deal of the power from the Speaker in appointing committees. And committee chairman. They wanted to each caucus name committee members. And of course, Phil, as Speaker, fought the tradition of the Speaker having that power to do it, and again, makes for somewhat of a more efficient operation. But on the other hand, it does put a great deal of power in the Speaker's hands, and it was simply an attempt to change some rules and the way the legislature did business. Phil was tremendously upset by it, and he had to deal with those people all during the session, and it caused a lot of headaches for him and I think for other people in the House.
Representative Vera Katz, from a Democrat from Portland, who later became Speaker of the House, said that it's well to talk about diffusing the power of the House Speaker, but if you're going to do that, you should give the power to the elected representatives from your own caucus rather than to self-appointed leaders. And she went on to say that as soon as the special interests found that they had a captive audience in the Rules Committee, we began to see everyone trying to stick a foot in the door to set the legislative process backwards.
Sure,
was that really going on that way?
I think so. You know, if you're going to move power, you want to be sure where you're moving it to, and that those people are going to act responsibly, and that if the objective was to share power, but yet it ended up in just the hands of a few people, that was not what was contemplated. And so I think Vera's statement is good, that if you're gonna change the rules and your objective is to spread the power around among more people, then that didn't really happen in the 77 session, because it ended up with the coalition, the six people, but calling most of the shots.
The Statesman Journal, Ron Blakenbacher, said that by the 177th day, the legislature has been described in this column as a mirage, a woolly mammoth with three hooves caught in the tar pit of indecision, a military unit practicing disbursement for a rifle drill, and so forth. Were things really that?
Well, Blankenbaker is a pretty critical observer of the legislature, and I mean, that's his job. And so he was trying to put into words, I think, the frustration that many people felt in the 77th session. But most all of that frustration was in the House, except when we had bills from the Senate that some of us wanted passed, mm-hmm. then we had to deal with them. 77 might have been a real turning point in terms of trying to get some responsible power in mm-hmm. more people. However, I'm not sure that that is exactly what resulted, even in later sessions, because as I observed it from afar after I went on the court, there seemed to be a growing antagonism, particularly on a partisan basis, between individuals, and less cooperation, mm-hmm. Less bipartisanship on certain issues, that it was just constantly being critical and almost mean to people of the other party, depending upon what party was in power.
Was the coalition able to provide any kind of direction for what was going
on? I don't know. I can't really answer uh-huh. that, since I was not in the House, did not observe them on a day-to-day basis. Most of what I knew I picked up from newspapers and also from mm-hmm. just talking with people in the House. Certainly they were a disruptive force in that session.
The Statesman Journal said that one of the major accomplishments of the legislature was a community corrections program, creating local centers for housing for low-risk inmates. I don't know if we talked about that or not. But
No, I don't remember that. Uh-huh. I don't remember what resulted from that. Later, we did get the minimum security facilities located, but that comes in the Goldsmith administration some years later. The theory is to have inmates who are serving time be more productive and therefore keep them in a community where they can actually perhaps hold down jobs, mm-hmm. but nevertheless stay in the facilities mm-hmm. in the mm-hmm. evening. And so it was a step to try to take care of the overcrowding and also for rehabilitation mm-hmm. purposes. But I don't know what happened as a result of that legislation, Clark. I don't know how much community facilities were built or what.
Another accomplishment that the Statesman Journal talked about was the revision of the state timber tax system and encouraging planting of trees rather than cutting. Well, not rather than cutting, but just encouraging the planting and growing of trees.
Again, that would not have been an area that in one of my committees, but it sounds like a good progressive piece of legislation as far as the environment is concerned.
How does the legislature break down regionally and politically? I mean, in terms of spheres of influence
Well, there's always been this tremendous conflict between urban mm-hmm. or the whole Willamette Valley mm-hmm. and Eastern Oregon, and oftentimes Southern Oregon joining with Eastern Oregon. Mm-hmm. Feeling that the problems are different, the people think differently, lifestyles are different. Yeah. Portland has kinds of problems that Eastern Oregon doesn't have in terms of environment and mass transit and school districts and all that sort of thing. And so it's hard to represent the whole state when there's so much diversity in the state. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I think the urban people have tended to be fair about Eastern Oregon. Eastern Oregonians might not think that way, but I think that certainly I, having spent much time in Eastern Oregon, living there, was always attuned to it and acutely aware of the kinds of positions they had. Mm-hmm. More conservative in Eastern Oregon, mm-hmm. More business-oriented, and less environment-oriented, because they don't have the masses of people there to deal with as we do in the Willamette Valley, in the urban area. So it made for conflicts. Uh-huh. And it made for dividing up, even within the party, uh-huh. The interests.
There seem to be some Democratic pockets, and they're conservative Democratic pockets, but I'm wondering how they got established, like, say, around Klamath Falls, where you had Harry Boyvin, Fred Hurd, people that...
Well, Fred Hurd and Harry Boyvin were very different legislators.
Yeah.
Harry played his politics very, very carefully, uh-huh. very astutely. But I would characterize Harry as a real conservative. Mm-hmm. I would not characterize Fred Hurd as a conservative, more moderate. But certainly on civil liberties issues and that mm-hmm. sort of thing, Fred was always there. Mm-hmm. And yet they were both Democrats, but two different kinds of Democrats.
And yet coming from the same community.
And in order to be elected, a person has to identify with his or her community, mm-hmm. or they're not going to be elected.
Right.
So there has to be the willingness to say, I know the needs here, uh-huh. and I will go to the legislature and represent those needs. Uh-huh. Then, after those needs are met, which generally are economic, mm-hmm. for the most part in Eastern Oregon, then a more moderate person could take a more liberal position on civil liberties or mm-hmm. on or on the arts or on, you know, the art commission budget.
Because they don't directly influence the community.
No, right. They don't directly influence the community. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true of the urban people who could take their positions on school funding for the largest school district in the state, Portland School District, and protect that interest, which, by the way, in basic school support distribution formula, Portland and Eastern Oregon were usually teamed up together mm. because of the kinds of tax bases they had and whether there was a need for the equalization and to what degree. And so sometimes you saw some of these strange alliances on issues, and basic school support is the best example, really, mm-hmm. of how they worked through the years for the same objective. And so any legislator, once that district is tended to and that district's mm-hmm. problems are recognized, and that legislator has done for the district what the legislator can do, then there are a lot of other issues that a person can turn to. And it makes a difference whether that person then is a Fred Hurd or a Harry Boyvin on the other kinds of issues. And that's when you begin to see the difference between liberal and conservative.
Mm-hmm. Who did you tend to work with most closely while you were in the legislature?
Well, I worked very closely with Betty Brown because she was the second woman to join me in the Senate by 77, well, by 73, 75, Mary Roberts was in the Senate. So there were three of us.
Did you work closely with Mary Wendy Roberts?
Yes, on legislation. Yes, uh-huh. I did. Uh-huh. Yeah. Mary and I, you know, had a good political relationship.
You did?
Yeah. We agreed on almost mm-hmm. all the issues. As far as the men are concerned, Jason Bow certainly, as the president of the Senate, had a good relationship with Jason, with Ted Halleck, and with Frank Roberts, who was then in the Senate, with Keith Burbridge. You know, most all of them, and I thought even many of the Republicans that I had a good working relationship with, certainly Senator Attia, Wally Carson, who I'd served with both on the Education Committee, Ken Jernsted from the Dalles, really a great working relationship with him, because he had been on my Consumer and Business Affairs Committee, mm-hmm. Even, you know, other senators, generally I respected their position, mm-hmm. and we had good friendship relationship. If they couldn't vote for a bill, it was at least enough that they could tell me they couldn't and give me an opportunity to try to sway them, mm-hmm. to try to influence them. But there was no personal problems between any of the legislators.
As far as the women's group was concerned, was there a coalition on issues that was effective?
The first caucus, women's caucus, uh-huh. Was in 73 when we decided it was time for all the women to get together. Then we continued that in 75. By 77, it was a little bit more loosely knit group because many of the women who were coming in were, a lot of women's issues had been achieved. a lot of the legislation had been passed. We would team up then on women's issues as a rule. But many of the women were branching out into a lot of other areas, environment, taxes. It's interesting to note in the last session, the 93 session, that there was a woman who was chair of the tax committee, House Tax Committee, and a woman who was chair of the Senate Tax Committee. That would, when I was in the legislature, that would have been a very strange phenomenon. And so I think that women were beginning to see that we can take on these other issues, and we will take on these issues, other issues, and then they would work themselves into a position of leadership, as Vera Katz did when she became Speaker of the House. So in order to do that, you have to have a good handle on a lot of the major issues.
Can you think of examples where you were allied with someone who later you became an adversary to on another issue?
Oh, it happened quite regularly, Clark. And that's one reason you wanted to stay friends with people, because you didn't want to embarrass them or make personal accusatory remarks about them, because you'd always need them on the next vote. And so once a vote was over, you know, you hoped your any animosity was dead, that had if it had developed. Or you tried to rehabilitate yourself with someone so that you would be able to convince them on the next vote.
How would you do that?
So, generally after a vote, saying to the person, "This is why I had to oppose your bill." Sometimes just through the social activities or over lunch in the Senate cafeteria and that sort of thing. You know, it just, it's a normal relationship. You let something go and start again.
I can't remember whether I've asked you or not, but before, but were there legislators who on the floor could change the direction of a bill or influence legislation by the power of their own speech?
Well, I think it would have to be a very close vote in the first place. And, well, not necessarily. Because it might be that there is a bill that would be that would have a majority support, and someone who you thought was going to oppose it would vote for it after the debate on the floor. But those would be people who were sitting on the fence anyway, I would guess. They hadn't made up their mind. Because it would be it's rare, but it happens, of course, when someone says, "I'm adamantly opposed to that, and here's my reasons." To get their vote just through an argument on the floor of the Senate. There were some eloquent speeches, of course, and given on the floor, but usually everyone's mind was made up before they ever voted. A few could be swayed.
But were there people that were very powerful in the way they could
negotiate
people
behind the scenes?
Well, either negotiate behind the scenes or right on the floor, where they were so dynamic in the way that they could express an issue.
I think Ted Halleck was probably the best person to. I mean, he certainly had a great command of the English language, and it was always a delightful experience. We knew Ted was going to carry a bill, and particularly one that he felt very strongly about, because he just always was eloquent in his speech and. Or at least colorful. I don't know whether I want to use the word eloquent, but at least colorful in his speech. And but I'm not sure that he necessarily influenced people by that speaking behavior. What happens in most legislative arenas is that you work behind the scenes and get your votes lined up. Right. You go to their office, you talk to them about this issue, provide them with the information, get their constituents to call them, say, "I want you to support this bill." You put the pressure on behind the scenes and hope that before you ever get to the floor that you've got your 16 votes. And then if others decide to vote with you, you know, so much the better. You've just got a bigger group. When you're trying to pick up one or two votes, then it's very important what happens on the floor, because you may be able to influence that one or two votes, but it's still would be people who had not made up their mind in most instances.
Did you see instances of people trading votes?
Oh, I'm sure it happened. Mm-hmm. And it's not, I'll vote for your bill if you'll vote for mine sort of thing. I mean, you know, that's too obvious. It's more, I have this bill and it's going to be on the floor tomorrow and I hope you'll be able to support it. Well, then the other senator may say, okay, by the way, I want to talk with you. This is a good opportunity for me to talk to you about something that'll be on the floor next week. And so you get involved in this conversation, and you know that a quid pro quo is in the making, probably, and without even promising, you know, yes, I'll vote for it. Or so just a lot of understanding how the other person operates and what you can say to that person in order to convince the person that, okay, my bill's important, your bill's important, your bill isn't going to hurt my constituents, so I can vote for your bill. Right. And you ought to be able to vote for mine for the same reason. Mm-hmm. And so, but that all happens usually without saying it, like I just said it.
Sure.
You just talk about the issue and about how it's good proposed legislation.
Some legislators that I've talked to claim that they've never traded a vote very adamantly. Is that possible, or is it just not an obvious trading of votes?
The question is, you know, what do they mean by trading?
Yeah.
I mean, if it's this, what I said, you vote for my bill, I vote for yours,
Yeah. That
doesn't happen.
Right.
And I think most legislators, including myself, want to be viewed as voting only on the basis of issues, mm-hmm. not because somebody else mm-hmm. wanted us to vote. You know, for their bill.
Right.
But on the other hand, you have to have a lot of faith in the people that you're dealing with. You can't know everything about every issue in the legislature. I mean, you've asked me a lot about taxes and about
sure.
highways and that sort of thing. I wasn't on those committees. Mm-hmm. And so I would have to we would take up these really important issues in caucus, and so that everybody would get an understanding from the people on those committees mm-hmm. of the importance and significance of a measure. But we would, so you take a lot of the information on faith. There's always some place to check, however. Lobbyists, you know, you can say, well, this legislator has told me that this is what this bill would do. What do you think it'll do? Or you can get staff mm-hmm. to do research, or mm-hmm. you can get legislative counsel to do some research, or you can get go to the committee, some of the other members of the committee, mm-hmm. and say, tell me your viewpoint on this particular issue. So, you know, it's a lot of research and a lot of analyzing and a lot of thinking and simple research to try to figure out how you should vote. And it may end up looking like a trade.
Right.
It may end up looking like a trade. It may, in fact, have been a trade. Mm-hmm. But it isn't done as a factual thing, like my vote for your vote.
I hear legislators say that once somebody has committed to vote for their bill, then they're really held to that, and if they, quote, go south on them, that their reputations are
right,
ruined.
Right. And, you know, that's the gentleman's word is his bond sort of feeling that exists mm-hmm. there. That if you get a commitment and particularly if you don't tell the person that you've changed your mind.
Right.
If you just, because that person is counting the votes. And you go on the floor thinking you've got 16 votes and somebody doesn't vote with you that said yeah. he or she would have, then you've only got 15 votes in the Senate and it doesn't pass. Mm-hmm. If that person had told the sponsor of the bill or the person who was going to carry the bill on the floor about that, that person could go out and work for another vote. Mm-hmm. And so that's what legislators don't like. They don't like to be blindsided
right.
When they think they've got the votes lined up and then have someone say, well, I changed my mind last night after this lobbyist talked to me without explaining it.
Right. Right.
So I'm sure that I quote, traded votes. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that I worked with other people on their legislation in order to have them be favorable toward my legislation.
Sure.
But it was not done on the basis of, well, I think we've already talked about the Dentress bill, mm-hmm. in which I early on told Ted Halleck I would vote against it, and then wished later that I had not given him that flat-out promise. At the time, I thought we should not have the dentures bill. As the session went on and I was lobbied on the bill and got information on it, I felt the other way. The question was, could I go to Ted and say, Ted, I'm not going to vote for your bill. And I did go to Ted and say, I'm having, you know, reservations about this bill. And he said, you know, and his comment was, my vote's so close, Betty, I can't, you know, let you get off the hook. And I should have said, too bad, Ted, you know, I've changed my mind. But it was one of those sort of fence-sitting issues. Yeah. Is this good? Is this really going to work the way the lobbyists for the senior citizens want it to work or not? And so I held firm with Ted on that particular vote.
In sort of a similar fashion, you were highly criticized for supporting the sales tax measure going to the people.
Right.
And as you looked back upon that, do you feel that that was a wise decision?
Oh, yes. Yeah, in 69, when Al Flagel and I, two Democrats, voted for the sales tax, that certainly was not a quid pro quo at all. I mean, we weren't saying anything to the people supporting the sales tax that we're going to give you a vote. In fact, they didn't even know we were going to give them a vote until the morning that the sales tax was on the floor. But the reason I did it, and I think the reason that Al did it, was that the sales tax proposal had hung up the legislature for two or three sessions, certainly as long as I had been there, 65, 67, then I got the Senate in 69, and that a lot of vote trading went on with the sales tax. Or bills would be held hostage in committees until a legislator would go to the chairman and say, I want a hearing on my bill. And the chairman would say, how are you on the sales tax? And so we saw a lot of that kind of game playing. And Al and I said, let's kick the thing out of here, get it out for a vote of the people. It's out of our control now and out of our jurisdiction, so to speak. We can get on with other major issues. And no one can hold legislation hostage on the basis of a position on sales tax. So, yes, I have never regretted that vote on the sales tax.
In your presiding over committees, were there any, was there any way in which you you were the chair that varied from you know, the way other people would chair committees?
Well, I think I was a good chair, and I was told that many times because, you know, I'm an efficient person, and I like to keep things moving. I don't like to sit and listen to a lot of testimony that is not on point or needless testimony after we've had a lot, you know, that's just repetitious. And so I really moved my committee along at a very great speed. And when we would have hearings, we'd lay down the ground rules, how long they could testify and who was going to testify when and so on. As far as my relationship with the committees was concerned, we had our bill books there and I scheduled the hearings for the legislation that was assigned to our committee. And if I didn't schedule it when some member of the committee or some other legislator wanted it, I had the power to revise all of the agenda and do that sort of thing. But legislation I wanted out of my committee, I had to work in the committee with the people who were on the committee to get their favorable votes. And that's the job of a committee chair. That's the power of a committee chair, is to kill the legislation that's there that you don't feel is appropriate for whatever reason or good, and pass what you do. And so the chairman of each committee has a tremendous amount of power. I mean, some bills you never schedule a hearing on.
Right.
And they can go till the end of the session, and sometime during the last week, the sponsor of the bill wakes up and says, why hasn't my bill had a hearing? And then they'll come to you and say, and demand a hearing. So a lot of that activity takes place toward the end of the session. The push to see how far you can get with a proposal.
Were there regional or national issues? We've talked a little bit about the ERA. I'm thinking of any others that might have impacted you while you were in the legislature?
National issues, I think after 68, the assassination of Kennedy and Martin Luther King, that we sent a memorial to Congress on gun control. We regularly have memorials to Congress. Every state does that. And we're told by people in D.C. it doesn't amount to a hill of beans, you know, that sure, it's a way for a state legislature to send a message to their their elected congressmen and U.S. senators. But we can, through that memorial, have a method by which we can communicate on federal issues.
Mm-hmm. And what about communicating with your constituency? How would you reach them
during the session? Sometimes some legislators do sort of a mailing. Mm-hmm. It's become more prominent now than it was then.
Like a newsletter?
Like a newsletter. Send a mailing out. I don't think I ever did a mailing. Mm-hmm. I did sometimes write articles for the for some of the local small newspapers, weekly newspapers, such as the Hollywood News or the Gresham Outlook, or some of those.